Chapter 2. All at once Mushkin went up to Yevgeny Pavlovich. "Yevgeny Pavlovich," he said with strange heat, seizing his hand, "believe that I look upon you as the best and most honourable of men in spite of everything. Be sure of that." Yevgeny Pavlovich positively drew back a step with surprise. For a moment he was struggling with an irresistible desire to laugh, but looking closer he saw that Mushkin seemed not himself, or at least was in a peculiar state of mind. "I don't mind betting, Prince," he cried, "that you didn't mean to say that, nor perhaps to speak to me at all. But what's the matter with you? Are you feeling ill?" "That may be. That may well be. And you were very clever to notice that perhaps it was not you I meant to address." He said this with a strange and even absurd smile, but, seeming suddenly excited, he cried, "Don't remind me of my conduct 3 days ago. I've been very much ashamed for the last 3 days. I know that I was to blame. But what have you done so dreadful?" "I see that you are perhaps more ashamed of me than anyone, Yevgeny Pavlovich. You are blushing. That's the sign of a good heart. I'm going away directly. You may be sure of that." "What's the matter with him? Do his fits begin like this?"
Lizaveta Prokofievna asked Kolya in alarm.
"Don't be uneasy, Lizaveta Prokofievna. I'm not in a fit, and I'm just going. I know that I am afflicted. I've been ill for 24 years, from my birth till I was 24 years old. You must take what I say as from a sick man now. I'm going directly. Directly, you may be sure of that. I'm not ashamed, for it would be strange to be ashamed of that, wouldn't it? But I'm out of place in society. I'm not speaking from wounded vanity. I've been reflecting during these 3 days, and I've made up my mind that I ought to explain things sincerely and honourably to you at the first opportunity. There are ideas, very great ideas, of which I ought not to begin to speak, because I should be sure to make everyone laugh. Prince S. has warned me of that very thing just now. My gestures are unsuitable. I've no right sense of proportion. My words are incongruous, not befitting the subject, and that's a degradation for those ideas. And so I have no right. Besides, I'm morbidly sensitive. I am certain that no one would hurt my feelings in this house, and that I am more loved here than I deserve. But I know for certain, that 20 years' illness must leave traces, so that it's impossible not to laugh at me, sometimes. It is so, isn't it?" He looked about him as though expecting an answer. All were standing in painful perplexity at this unexpected, morbid, and in any case apparently causeless outbreak. But this outbreak gave rise to a strange episode.
"But why are you saying that here?" cried Aglaya suddenly. "Why do you say it to them? Them, them!"
She seemed to be stirred to the highest pitch of indignation. Her eyes flashed fire. Mushkin stood facing her, dumb and speechless. Then he suddenly turned pale.
"There's not one person here who's worth such words," Aglaya burst out. "There is no one here, no one who is worth your little finger, nor your mind, nor your heart. You are more honourable than any of them, nobler, better, kinder, cleverer than any of them. Some of them are not worthy to stoop to pick up the handkerchief you have just dropped. Why do you humble yourself and put yourself below them? Why do you distort everything in yourself? Why have you no pride? Mercy on us! Who could have expected this?"
cried Lizaveta Prokofievna, throwing up her hands.
"The poor knight! Hurrah!"
cried Kolya, enchanted.
"Be silent! How dare they insult me in your house?"
cried Aglaya, suddenly flying out at her mother. She was by now in that hysterical state when no line is drawn and no check regarded.
"Why do you all torture me, every one of you? Why have they been pestering me for the last 3 days on your account, Prince? Nothing will induce me to marry you. Let me tell you that I never will on any consideration. Understand that. As though one could marry an absurd creature like you. Look at yourself in the looking-glass. What do you look like standing there? Why do they tease me and say I'm going to marry you? You ought to know that. You're in the plot with them, too."
"No one has ever teased you about it," muttered Adelaida in alarm.
"No one has ever thought of such a thing. No one has said a word about it,"
cried Alexandra.
"Who has been teasing her? When has she been teased? Who could have said such a thing? Is she raving?"
Lizaveta Prokofievna addressed the room, quivering with anger.
"Everyone has been talking about it, everyone, for the last 3 days. I will never, never marry him!"
As she cried this, Aglaya burst into bitter tears, hiding her face in her handkerchief and sank into a chair.
"But he hasn't even..."
"I haven't asked you, Aglaya Ivanovna," broke suddenly from Mushkin.
"What?"
Lizaveta Prokofievna brought out in indignation, amazement and horror.
"What's that?"
She could not believe her ears.
I meant to say,
faltered Mushkin. "I only wanted to explain to Aglaya Ivanovna, to have the honour to make clear to her that I had no intention, to have the honour of asking for her hand at any time. It's not my fault. It's not my fault indeed, Aglaya Ivanovna. I've never wanted to. It never entered my head. I never shall want to. You'll see that for yourself. Be sure of that. Some spiteful person must have slandered me to you. Don't worry about it." As he said this, he went up to Aglaya. She removed the handkerchief with which she was covering her face, stole a hasty glance at his panic-stricken countenance, took in the meaning of his words, and went off into a sudden fit of laughter in his face. Such gay and irresistible laughter, such droll and mocking laughter, that Adelaida could not contain herself, especially when she too looked at Mushkin. She rushed up to her sister, embraced her, and broke into the same irresistible, schoolgirlish and merry laughter. Looking at them, Mushkin too began to smile, and with a joyful and happy expression repeated,
"Well, that's all right. That's all right."
At that point, Alexandra too gave way and laughed heartily. It seemed as though the three girls would never stop laughing.
"Oh, the mad things," muttered Lizaveta Prokofievna. "First they frightened one, and then..."
But Prince S. was laughing too, and so was Yevgeny Pavlovich. Kolya laughed without stopping, and Mushkin laughed also, looking at them all.
"Let's go for a walk! Let's go for a walk!" cried Adelaida. "All of us, and the prince must go with us. There's no need for you to go away, you dear person. Isn't he a dear, Aglaya? Isn't he, Mother? What's more, I must kiss him and embrace him for his explanation to Aglaya just now. Mammon, dear, will you let me kiss him? Aglaya, let me kiss your prince!"
cried the mischievous girl, and she actually skipped up to the prince and kissed him on the forehead. He snatched her hands, squeezed them so tightly that Adelaida almost cried out, looked at her with infinite gladness, and quickly raised her hand to his lips and kissed it three times.
"Come along," Aglaya called to them. "Prince, you shall escort me. May he, Mammon, after refusing me? You've refused me for good, haven't you, Prince? That's not the way to offer your arm to a lady. Don't you know how to give your arm to a lady? That's right. Come along, we'll lead the way. Would you like us to go on ahead? Tete-a-tete."
She talked incessantly, still laughing spasmodically.
"Thank God, thank God,"
repeated Lizaveta Prokofievna, though she did not know herself what she was rejoicing at. "Extraordinary queer people," thought Princess, perhaps for the 100th time since he had known them, but he liked these queer people. As for Mushkin, he was perhaps not greatly attracted by him. Princess looked rather gloomy, and, as it were, preoccupied as they set off. Yevgeny Pavlovich seemed in the liveliest humour. All the way to the railway station, he was amusing Adelaida and Alexandra, who laughed at his jokes with such extreme readiness that he began to be a trifle suspicious that perhaps they were not listening to him at all. At this thought, he suddenly broke into violent and perfectly genuine laughter, without explaining the reason. His amusement was characteristic of the man. Though the sisters were in the most hilarious mood, they kept looking at Aglaya and Mushkin in front of them. It was evident that their younger sister's conduct was a complete enigma to them. Prince S. kept trying to talk about other subjects to Lizaveta Prokofievna, perhaps to distract her mind, and bored her horribly. She seemed completely dazed, answered at random, and sometimes did not answer at all. But that was not the end of Aglaya's enigmas that evening. The last of them fell to the lot of Mushkin alone. When they had got about 100 paces from the house, Aglaya said in a rapid half-whisper to her obstinately silent cavalier,
"Look there to the right."
Mushkin looked.
"Look more carefully. Do you see that seat in the park, over there where those three big trees are? A green seat?"
Mushkin answered that he did.
"Do you like the place? I sometimes come and sit here alone at 7 o'clock in the morning, when everyone else is asleep."
Mushkin murmured that it was a charming spot.
"And now you can leave me. I don't want to walk arm in arm with you any further. Or better, walk arm in arm with me, but don't speak to me. Not a word. I want to think by myself."
This warning was unnecessary, however. Mushkin would not have uttered a word in any case. His heart began throbbing violently when she spoke of the seat in the park.
After a minute's deliberation, he dismissed the foolish idea with shame. It is a well-known fact remarked by everyone that the public about the Pavlovsk bandstand is more select on weekdays than on Sundays and holidays, when all sorts of people flock there from town. The ladies, though not in holiday attire, are more elegant. It is the correct thing to gather about the bandstand. The orchestra is about the best of our park bands, and often plays new pieces. There is great decorum and propriety of behaviour in the gardens, though there is a general air of homeliness and even intimacy. Summer visitors go there to look at their acquaintances. Many do this with genuine pleasure and frequent the gardens for that purpose alone. But there are some who only go for the music. Unpleasant scenes are rare, though of course they occasionally occur, even on weekdays. But that, to be sure, is inevitable. It was an exquisite evening, and there were a good many people in the gardens. All the places round the orchestra were taken. Our party sat down on chairs rather apart, close to the left-hand exit from the station. The crowd and the music revived Lizaveta Prokofievna a little and diverted the young ladies. They had already exchanged glances with some of the visitors and had already nodded affably to several of their acquaintances. They had scrutinized the dresses, detected some eccentricities, and discussed them with sarcastic smiles. Yevgeny Pavlovich, too, bowed frequently to acquaintances. Aglaya and Mushkin, who were still together, had already attracted some attention. Soon several young men went up to the young ladies and their mother. Two or three remained to talk to them. They were all friends of Yevgeny Pavlovich's. Among them was a very handsome, good-humoured and talkative young officer. He hastened to address Aglaya and did his utmost to engage her attention. She was particularly gracious and sprightly with him. Yevgeny Pavlovich asked Mushkin to let him introduce this friend. Mushkin hardly took in what was wanted of him, but the introduction took place. Both bowed and shook hands. Yevgeny Pavlovich's friend asked a question, but Mushkin either did not answer or mumbled something so strangely to himself that the officer stared at him, then glanced at Yevgeny Pavlovich, at once saw why the introduction had been made, smiled slightly, and turned to Aglaya again. Only Yevgeny Pavlovich noticed that Aglaya suddenly flushed at this. Mushkin did not even observe that other people were talking and paying attention to Aglaya. He was perhaps at moments even unconscious that he was sitting beside her. Sometimes he longed to get away, to vanish from here altogether. He would have been positively glad to be in some gloomy, deserted place, only that he might be alone with his thoughts, and no one might know where he was. Or at least to be at home in the veranda, with no one else there, not Lebediev nor the children. To throw himself on the sofa and bury his head in the pillow, and to lie like that for a day and a night, and another day. At moments he dreamed of the mountains, and especially one familiar spot which he always liked to think of, a spot to which he had been fond of going, and from which he used to look down on the village, on the waterfall gleaming like a white thread below, on the white clouds and the old ruined castle. Oh, how he longed to be there now, and to think of one thing. Oh, of nothing else for his whole life, and 1,000 years would not be too long. And let him be utterly forgotten here. Oh, that must be. It would have been better indeed if they had never known him, and if it had all been only a dream. And wasn't it just the same, dream and reality? Sometimes he began looking at Aglaya, and for 5 minutes at a time did not take his eyes off her face. But the look in his eyes was too strange. He seemed to be looking at her as an object a mile away, or as at her portrait, not herself.
"Why are you looking at me like that, Prince?"
she asked him suddenly, interrupting her lively talk and laughter with the group around her.
"I'm afraid of you. I feel as though you meant to put out your hand and touch my face and feel it with your fingers. He does look like that, doesn't he, Yevgeny Pavlovich?"
Mushkin seemed surprised to hear that he was being spoken to, pondered, though perhaps he did not quite understand, and did not answer. But seeing that she and all the rest were laughing, he opened his mouth and began to laugh too. The laughter grew louder. The officer, who must have been of a mirthful disposition, simply shook with laughter. Aglaya suddenly whispered to herself wrathfully,
"Idiot! Good heavens! Surely she can't be... A man like that, is she utterly mad?"
her mother muttered to herself.
"It's a joke. The same as that about the poor knight, nothing more,"
Alexandra whispered firmly in her ear.
"She's making fun of him again, as she always does. But the joke has gone too far. We must put a stop to it, Maman. She went on like an actress and scared us out of pure mischief." "It's a good thing she's pitched on an idiot like that,"
her mother whispered back. But her daughter's remark had relieved her. Mushkin heard them call him an idiot, however, and started, but not at being called an idiot. He forgot the word immediately. But in the crowd, not far from where he was sitting, he could not have pointed out the exact spot, he caught a glimpse of a face, a pale face with curly black hair, with a familiar, a very familiar smile and expression. He caught a glimpse of it and it vanished. Very likely it was only his fancy. All that remained with him was an impression of a wry smile, the eyes and the jaunty pale green necktie of the apparition. Whether the figure had disappeared in the crowd, or whether it had slipped into the station, Mushkin could not decide. But a minute later he began quickly and uneasily looking about him. This first apparition might be the forerunner of a second. That must certainly be so. Could he have forgotten the possibility of a meeting when he went into the gardens? It is true that when he went to the gardens, he had no idea that he was coming there. He was in such a troubled state of mind. If he had been more capable of observing, he might have noticed for the last quarter of an hour that Aglaia, too, was looking round uneasily from time to time. She, too, seemed to be on the lookout for someone. Now, when his uneasiness had become very marked, Aglaia's excitement and uneasiness also increased, and as soon as he looked round him, she at once looked about, too. The explanation of their uneasiness followed quickly. Quite a number of persons, at least a dozen, suddenly appeared from the side entrance, near where Mushkin and the Epanchins and their friends were sitting. The foremost of the group were three women, two of them remarkably good-looking, and it was not strange that they were followed by so many admirers. But there was something peculiar about the women and the men who were there with them, quite unlike the rest of the crowd gathered to listen to the music. They were at once noticed by almost everyone, but most people tried to look as though they had not seen them at all, and only some of the young men smiled at them, whispering something to one another. It was impossible to avoid seeing them. They displayed themselves conspicuously, talking loudly and laughing. It might well have been thought that many of them were drunk, though some of them were smartly and fashionably dressed. Yet there were among them persons of very strange appearance, in strange clothes, with strangely flushed faces. There were some officers among them. Some were not young. Some were solidly dressed in well-cut, comfortably fitting clothes, with rings and studs and splendid pitch-black wigs and whiskers, with especially stately, though rather grumpy, dignity in their faces. Yet they would have been shunned in society like the plague. Among our suburban places of resort, there are, of course, some distinguished for exceptional respectability and enjoying a particularly good reputation. But even the most cautious person may sometimes be struck by a tile from a neighbour's roof. Such a tile was now about to fall on the decorous public who had gathered to listen to the band. On the way from the station to the bandstand, there were three steps. The group stopped just at the top of these steps. They hesitated whether to go down, but one woman stepped forward. Only two of her suite ventured to follow her. One was a middle-aged man of rather modest appearance. He looked like a gentleman in all respects, yet he had the forlorn air of one of those men whom nobody knows and who knows nobody. The other was a most dubious figure, completely out at elbows. Nobody else followed the eccentric lady, but going down the steps she did not look back, as though she did not care whether she were followed or not. She laughed and talked loudly as before. She was dressed richly and with excellent taste, but somewhat too splendidly. She turned towards the other side of the bandstand, where a private carriage was waiting for somebody. Mushkin had not seen her for more than 3 months. Ever since he had arrived in Petersburg, he had been intending to go and see her, but perhaps a secret presentiment had deterred him. He could not in any case gauge what impression meeting her would make upon him, and he often tried with dread to imagine it. One thing was clear to him, that the meeting would be painful. Several times during those 6 months he had recalled the first impression made on him by that woman's face, when he'd only seen it in the photograph. But even the impression made by the photograph was, he remembered, extremely painful. That month in the provinces, when he had been seeing her almost every day, had had a fearful effect upon him, so much so that he sometimes tried to drive away all recollection of it. There was something which always tortured him in the very face of this woman. Talking to Rogojin, he had put down this sensation to his infinite pity for her, and that was the truth. That face, even in the photograph, had roused in him a perfect agony of pity. The feeling of compassion, and even of suffering over this woman, never left his heart, and it had not left it now. Oh, no, it was stronger than ever. But Mushkin was dissatisfied with what he had said to Rogojin, and only now, at the moment of her sudden appearance, he realized, perhaps through his immediate sensation, what had been lacking in his words. Words had been lacking which might have expressed horror. Yes, horror. Now, at this moment, he felt it fully. He was certain, he was fully convinced, for reasons of his own, that that woman was mad. If loving a woman more than anything in the world, or foreseeing the possibility of loving her thus, one were suddenly to see her in chains, behind an iron grating and beneath the rod of a prison warder, one would feel something like what Mushkin felt at that moment.
"What's the matter with you?"
Aglaya whispered quickly, looking round at him and naively pulling at his arm. He turned his head, looked at her, glanced into her black eyes, which flashed at that moment with a light he could not understand, tried to smile at her, but immediately, as though forgetting her, turned his eyes to the right and again began watching the startling apparition. Nastasia Philipovna was at that moment walking close by the young lady's chairs. Yevgeny Pavlovich went on telling Alexandra something which must have been very amusing and interesting. He talked rapidly and eagerly. Mushkin remembered that Aglaya had uttered in a whisper the words, "What a—" a vague, unfinished phrase. She instantly checked herself and said no more, but that was enough. Nastasia Philipovna, who was walking by, seeming to notice no one in particular, suddenly turned towards them, and seemed only now to observe Yevgeny Pavlovich.
"Papa! Why, here he is!"
she exclaimed, suddenly standing still.
"One might have sent a special messenger to look for him and never find him. And here he sits, where you'd never expect him. I thought you were there at your uncle's."
Yevgeny Pavlovich flushed, looking furiously at Nastasia Philipovna, but hurriedly turned away from her again.
"What? Don't you know? Only fancy. He doesn't know yet. He has shot himself. Your uncle shot himself this morning. I was told this morning at 2 o'clock, and half the town knows it by now. 350,000 rubles of government money are missing, they say. Some say 500. And I always counted on his leaving you a fortune. He's whisked it all away. He was a dissipated old fellow. Well, goodbye. Bon chance. Aren't you really going there? You sent in your papers in good time, you sly fellow." "Nonsense. He knew. He knew. Very likely he knew yesterday."
Though in her insolent persistence in this public proclamation of an acquaintance and intimacy which did not exist, there was certainly a motive, and of that there could be no doubt now, yet Yevgeny Pavlovich had thought at first of escaping without notice his assailant. But Nastasia Philipovna's words fell on him like a thunderbolt. Hearing of his uncle's death, he grew white as a sheet and turned towards his informant. At that moment, Lizaveta Prokofievna got up quickly from her seat, made everyone behind her get up, and almost ran away. Only Mushkin stayed for a moment in indecision, and Yevgeny Pavlovich still remained standing, unable to collect himself. But the Epanchins were scarcely 20 paces away when an outrageously scandalous incident followed. The officer, who was a great friend of Yevgeny Pavlovich's, and had been talking to Aglaya, was highly indignant.
"One wants a whip. There's no other way of dealing with such a hussy," he said almost loudly.
He had apparently been Yevgeny Pavlovich's confidant in the past. Nastasia Philipovna instantly turned to him. Her eyes flashed. She rushed up to a young man, a complete stranger, who was standing a couple of paces from her, snatched a thin, plaited riding whip out of his hand, and struck the offender with all her might across the face. All this happened in one moment. The officer beside himself flew at her. Nastasia Philipovna's followers were no longer beside her. The decorous middle-aged gentleman had managed to disappear altogether, while the festive gentleman stood aside, laughing heartily. In another minute the police would have appeared, and Nastasia Philipovna would have fared badly, if unexpected help had not been at hand. Mushkin, who was also standing two steps away, succeeded in seizing the officer by the arms from behind. Resting away his arms, the officer gave him a violent push in the chest. Mushkin was flung three paces back and fell on a chair, but two other champions had come forward to protect Nastasia Philipovna. Facing the attacking officer stood the boxer, the author of the article, already known to the reader, and formerly one of Rogozhin's retinue.
"Ex-Lieutenant Keller," he introduced himself forcibly. "If you want a fight, Captain, I'll replace the weaker sex at your service. I've been through a course of English boxing. Don't push, Captain. I feel for the deadly insult you've received, but I can't allow you to use your fists on a woman in public. If, like an honourable man and a gentleman, you prefer some other method, you know what I mean, Captain."
But the captain had recovered himself and was not listening. At that instant, Rogozhin made his appearance in the crowd, and seizing Nastasia Philipovna by the arm, led her away. Rogozhin, too, seemed terribly shaken. He was white and trembling. As he led Nastasia Philipovna away, he had time to laugh malignantly in the officer's face, and with vulgar triumph said,
"Phew! He's caught it. His mug's all over blood. Phew!"
Recovering himself, and completely realizing with whom he had to deal, the officer, though covering his face with his handkerchief, turned politely to Mushkin, who had got up from his chair.
"Prince Mushkin, whose acquaintance I have had the pleasure of making just now..."
"She's mad. She's insane, I assure you," responded Mushkin in a shaking voice, for some reason holding out his trembling hands to him.
"I, of course, cannot boast of so much knowledge on that subject, but I had to know your name."
He nodded and walked away. The police hurried up 5 seconds after the last of the persons concerned had disappeared, but the scene had not lasted more than 2 minutes. Some of the audience had got up from their chairs and gone away. Some had simply moved from one place to another, while some were delighted at the scene, and others were eagerly talking and inquiring about it. The incident, in fact, passed off in the usual way. The band began playing again. Mushkin followed the Epanchins. If he had thought, or had had time to look to the left as he was sitting there, after he had been pushed away, he might have seen 20 paces from him Aglaya, who had stood still to watch the scandalous scene, regardless of her mother's and sister's calls to her. Prince S. had run up to her, and at last persuaded her to come quickly away. Her mother remembered that she had returned to them so excited that she could scarcely have heard their calling her. But within 2 minutes, when they were walking back into the park, Aglaya said in her usual careless and capricious tones,
"I wanted to see how the farce would end."